Side 11, The Dark Half, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 413.
Don't look up now, George. Don't look up. Don't look out of the world you're making. Not now. Please, dear God, don't let him look out into the world of real things now.
On the blank sheet in front of him, he wrote the word Psychopomps in cold capital letters. He circled it. He drew an arrow below it, and below the arrow he wrote, The sparrows are flying.
Outside, a wind began to blow. Only it was no wind, it was the ruffling of millions of feathers, and it was inside Thad's head.
Suddenly that third eye opened in his mind, opened wider than it ever had before, and he saw Bergenfield, New Jersey, the empty houses, the empty streets, the mild spring sky. He saw the sparrows everywhere, more than there had ever been before. The world he had grown up in had become a vast aviary. Only it wasn't Bergenfield. It was Ennsville. Stark quit writing. His eyes widened with sudden, belated alarm. Thad drew in a deep breath and blew. The bird call Raleigh DeLesseps had given him uttered a strange, squealing note.
Thad, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Stark snatched for the bird call. Before he could touch it, there was a bang and it split open in Thad's mouth, cutting his lips. The sound woke the twins. Wendy began to cry. Outside, the rustle of the sparrows rose to a roar. They were flying. 3. Liz had started for the stairs when she heard Wendy begin to cry. Alan stood where he was for a moment, transfixed by what he saw outside. The land, the trees, the lake, the sky, they were all blotted out. The sparrows rose in a great wavering curtain, darkening the window from top to bottom and side to side. As the first small bodies began to thud into the reinforced glass, Alan's paralysis broke. Liz, he screamed. Liz, down! But she wasn't going to get down. Her baby was crying, and that was all she could think about. Alan sprinted across the room toward her, employing that almost eerie speed which was his own secret, and tackled her just as the entire window wall blew inward under the weight of 20,000 sparrows. 20,000 more followed them, and 20,000 more, and 20,000 more. In a moment, the living room was filled with them. They were everywhere. Alan threw himself on top of Liz and pulled her under the couch. The world was filled with the shrill cheeping of sparrows. Now they could hear the other windows breaking, all the windows. The house rattled with the thuds of tiny suicide bombers. Alan looked out and saw a world that was nothing but brown-black movement. Smoke detectors began to go off as birds crashed into them. Somewhere there was a monstrous crash as the TV screen exploded. Clatters as pictures on the walls fell. A series of metallic xylophone bonks as sparrows struck the pots hanging on the wall by the stove and knocked them to the floor. And still he could hear the babies crying and Liz screaming.
Let me go, my babies, let me go. I have to get my babies.
She squirmed halfway out from beneath him, and her upper body was immediately covered with sparrows. They caught in her hair and fluttered madly there. She beat at them wildly. Alan grabbed her and pulled her back. Through the eddying air of the living room, he could see a vast black cord of sparrows flowing up the stairs, up toward the office. 4. Stark reached for Thad as the first bird began to thump into the secret door. Beyond the wall, Thad could hear the muffled thud of falling paperweights and the tinkle of breaking glass. Both twins were wailing now. Their cries rose, blended with the maddening cheeping of the sparrows, and the two of them together made a kind of hell's harmony.
Stop it! Stark yelled. Stop it, Thad! Whatever the hell you're doing, just stop it!
He snatched for the gun, and Thad buried the pencil he had been holding in Stark's throat. Blood poured out in a rush. Stark turned toward him, gagging, clawing at the pencil. It bobbed up and down as he tried to swallow. He got one hand around it and pulled it out.
What are you doing? He croaked. What is it?
He heard the birds now. He did not understand them, but he heard them. His eyes rolled toward the closed door, and Thad saw real terror in those eyes for the first time.
I'm writing the end, George,
Thad said in a low voice neither Liz nor Alan heard downstairs.
I'm writing the end in the real world. All right, Stark said. Let's write it for all of us, then.
He turned toward the twins with the bloody pencil in one hand and the 45 in the other. 5. There was a folded afghan on the end of the sofa. Alan reached up for it, and what felt like a dozen hot sewing needles jabbed at his hand. "Damn!" he yelled and pulled the hand back. Liz was still trying to squirm out from under him. The monstrous whirring sound seemed to fill the whole universe now, and Alan could no longer hear the babies. But Liz Beaumont could. She wriggled and twisted and pulled. Alan fastened his left hand in her collar and felt the fabric rip. "Wait a minute!" he bellowed at her, but it was useless. There was nothing he could say to stop her while her children were screaming. Annie would have been the same. Alan reached up with his right hand again, ignoring the stabbing beaks this time, and snagged the afghan. It opened in tangled folds as it fell from the couch. From the master bedroom there was a tremendous crash as some piece of furniture, the bureau perhaps, fell over. Alan's distracted, overburdened mind tried to imagine how many sparrows it would take to tip over a bureau and could not. "How many sparrows does it take to screw in a light bulb?" his mind asked crazily. 3 to hold the bulb and 3 billion to turn the house." He yodeled crazy laughter, and then the big hanging globe in the center of the living room exploded like a bomb. Liz screamed and cringed back for a moment, and Alan was able to throw the afghan over her head. He got under it himself. They weren't alone even beneath it. Half a dozen sparrows were in there with them. He felt feathery wings flutter against his cheek, felt bright pain tattoo his left temple, and socked himself through the afghan. The sparrow tumbled to his shoulder and fell from beneath the blanket onto the floor. He yanked Liz against him and shouted into her ear, "We're going to walk. Walk, Liz, under this blanket. If you try to run, I'll knock you out. Nod your head if you understand." She tried to pull away. The afghan stretched. Sparrows landed briefly, bounced on it as if it were a trampoline, then flew again. Alan pulled her back against him and shook her by the shoulder, shook her hard. "Not if you understand, goddammit." He felt her hair tickle his cheek as she nodded. They crawled out from beneath the sofa. Alan kept his arm tightly around her shoulders, afraid she would bolt. And slowly they began to move across the swarming room, through the light, maddening clouds of crying birds. They looked like a joke animal in a county fair. A dancing donkey, with Mike as the head and Ike as the hindquarters. The living room of the Beaumont house was spacious, with a high cathedral ceiling. But now there seemed to be no air left. They walked through a yielding, shifting, bluey atmosphere of birds. Furniture crashed, birds thudded off walls, ceilings, and appliances. The whole world had become bird stink and strange percussion. At last they reached the stairs and began to sway slowly up them beneath the afghan, which was already coated with feathers and bird shit. And as they started to climb, a pistol shot crashed in the study upstairs. Now Alan could hear the twins again. They were shrieking. 6. Thad groped on the desk as Stark aimed the gun at William and came up with the paperweight Stark had been playing with. It was a heavy chunk of gray-black slate, flat on one side. He brought it down on Stark's wrist an instant before the big blond man fired, breaking the bone and driving the barrel of the gun downward. The crash was deafening in the small room. The bullet plowed into the floor an inch from William's left foot, kicking splinters onto the legs of his fuzzy blue sleep suit. The twins began to shriek, and as Thad closed with Stark, he saw them put their arms around each other in a gesture of spontaneous mutual protection. "Hansel and Gretel," he thought. And then Stark drove the pencil into his shoulder. Thad yelled with pain and shoved Stark away. Stark tripped over the typewriter which had been placed in the corner and fell backward against the wall. He tried to switch the pistol over to his right hand and dropped it. Now the sound of the birds against the door was a steady thunder, and it began to slip slowly open on its central pivot. A sparrow with a crushed wing oozed in and fell twitching on the floor. Stark felt in his back pocket and brought out the straight razor. He pulled the blade open with his teeth. His eyes sparkled crazily above the steel. "You want it, Hoss?" he asked, and Thad saw the decay falling into his face again, coming all at once like a dropped load of bricks. "You really do? Okay, you got it." 7. Halfway up the stairs, Liz and Alan were stopped. They ran into a yielding, suspended wall of birds and simply could make no progress against it. The air fluttered and hummed with sparrows. Liz shrieked in terror and fury. The birds did not turn on them, did not attack them. They just thwarted them. All the sparrows in the world, it seemed, had been drawn here to the second story of the Beaumont house in Castle Rock.
"Down!" Alan shouted at her. "Maybe we can crawl under them."
They dropped to their knees. Progress was possible at first, although not pleasant. They found themselves crawling over a crunching, bleeding carpet of sparrows at least 18 inches deep. Then they ran into that wall again. Looking under the hem of the Afghan, Alan could see a crowded, confused mass that beggared description. The sparrows on the stair risers were being crushed. Layers and layers of the living, but soon to be dead, stood on top of them. Farther up, perhaps 3 feet off the stairs, sparrows flew in a kind of suicide traffic zone, colliding and falling, some rising and flying again, others squirming in the masses of their fallen mates with broken legs or wings. Sparrows, Alan remembered, could not hover. From somewhere above them, on the other side of this grotesque living barrier, a man screamed. Liz seized him, pulled him close.
"What can we do?" she screamed. "What can we do, Alan?"
He didn't answer her, because the answer was nothing. There was nothing they could do. 8. Stark came toward Thad with the razor in his right hand. Thad backed toward the slowly moving study door with his eyes on the blade. He snatched up another pencil from the desk.
"That ain't gonna do you no good, Hoss," Stark said. "Not now."
Then his eyes shifted to the door. It had opened wide enough, and the sparrows flowed in, a river of them, and they flowed at George Stark. In an instant, his expression became one of horror and understanding.
"No," he screamed, and began to slash at them with Alexis Machine's straight razor. "No, I won't. I won't go back. You can't make me."
He cut one of the sparrows cleanly in half. It fell out of the air in 2 fluttering pieces. Stark ripped and flailed at the air around him. And Thad suddenly understood.
"I won't go back."
What was happening here? The psychopomps, of course, had come to serve as George Stark's escort. George Stark's escort back to Annsville. Back to the land of the dead. Thad dropped the pencil and retreated toward his children. The air was filled with sparrows. The door had opened almost all the way now. The river had become a flood. Sparrows settled on Stark's broad shoulders. They settled on his arms, on his head. Sparrows struck his chest, dozens of them at first, then hundreds. He twisted this way and that in a cloud of falling feathers and flashing, slashing beaks, trying to give back what he was getting. They covered the straight razor. Its evil silver gleam was gone, buried beneath the feathers that were stuck to it. Thad looked at his children. They had stopped weeping. They were looking up into the stuffed, boiling air with identical expressions of wonder and delight. Their hands were raised, as if to check for rain. Their tiny fingers were outstretched. Sparrows stood on them, and did not peck. But they were pecking Stark. Blood burst from his face in 100 places. One of his blue eyes winked out. A sparrow landed on the collar of his shirt and sent his beak diving into the hole Thad had made with the pencil in Stark's throat. The bird did it 3 times, fast, rat-tat-tat, like a machine gun, before Stark's groping hand seized it and crushed it like a piece of living origami. Thad crouched by the twins, and now the birds lit on him as well. Not pecking, just standing. And watching. Stark had disappeared. He had become a living, squirming bird sculpture. Blood oozed through the jostling wings and feathers. From somewhere below, Thad heard a shrieking, splintering sound. Wood giving way. "They have broken their way into the kitchen," he thought. He thought briefly of the gas lines that fed the stove, but the thought was distant, unimportant. And now he began to hear the loose, wet plop and smack of the living flesh being torn off George Stark's bones.
"They've come for you, George," he heard himself whisper. "They've come for you. God help you now."
9. Alan sensed space above him again and looked up through the diamond-shaped holes in the Afghan. Bird shit dripped onto his cheek and he wiped it away. The stairwell was still full of birds, but their numbers had thinned. Most of those still alive had apparently gotten where they were going.
"Come on," he said to Liz.
And they began to move up over the ghastly carpet of dead birds again. They had managed to gain the second floor landing when they heard Thad shriek.
"Take him, then! Take him! Take him back to hell where he belongs!"
And the whirring of the birds became a hurricane. 10. Stark made one last galvanic effort to get away from them. There was nowhere to go, nowhere to run, but he tried anyway. It was his style. The column of birds which had covered him moved forward with him. Gigantic puffy arms covered with feathers and heads and wings rose, beat themselves across his torso, rose again, and crossed themselves at the chest. Birds, some wounded, some dead, fell to the floor, and for one moment Thad was afforded a vision which would haunt him for the rest of his life. The sparrows were eating George Stark alive. His eyes were gone. Where they had been, only vast dark sockets remained. His nose had been reduced to a bleeding flap. His forehead and most of his hair had been struck away, revealing the mucus-bleared surface of his skull. The collar of his shirt still ringed his neck, but the rest was gone. Ribs poked out of his skin in white lumps. The birds had opened his belly. A drove of sparrows sat on his feet and looked up with bright attention and squabbled for his guts as they fell out in dripping, shredded chunks. And he saw something else. The sparrows were trying to lift him up. They were trying, and very soon, when they had reduced his body weight enough, they would do just that.
"Take him, then," he screamed. "Take him! Take him back to hell where he belongs!"
Stark's screams stopped as his throat disintegrated beneath 100 hammering, dipping beaks. Sparrows clustered under his armpits, and for a second his feet rose from the bloody carpet. He brought his arms, what remained of them, down into his sides in a savage gesture, crushing dozens. But dozens upon dozens more came to take their places. The sound of pecking and splintering wood to Thad's right suddenly grew louder, hollower. He looked in that direction and saw the wood of the study's east wall disintegrating like tissue paper. For an instant, he saw 1,000 yellow beaks burst through at once. And then he grabbed the twins and rolled over them, arching his body to protect them, moving with real grace for perhaps the only time in his life. The wall crashed inward in a dusty cloud of splinters and sawdust. Thad closed his eyes and hugged his children close to him. He saw no more. 11. But Alan Pangborn did, and Liz did too. They had pulled the Afghan down to their shoulders as the cloud of birds over them and around them shredded apart. Liz began to stumble into the guest bedroom toward the open study door, and Alan followed her. For a moment he couldn't see into the study. It was only a cloudy brown-black blur. And then he made out a shape, a horrible padded shape. It was Stark. He was covered with birds, eaten alive, and yet he still lived. More birds came. More still. Alan thought their horrid, shrill cheeping would drive him mad. And then he saw what they were doing.
"Alan!" Liz screamed. "Alan, they're lifting him!"
The thing which had been George Stark, a thing which was now only vaguely human, rose into the air on a cushion of sparrows. It moved across the office, almost fell, then rose unsteadily once more. It approached the huge splinter-ringed hole in the east wall. More birds flew in through this hole. Those which still remained in the guest room rushed into the study. Flesh fell from Stark's twitching skeleton in a grisly rain. The body floated through the hole with sparrows flying around it and tearing out the last of its hair. Alan and Liz struggled over the rug of dead birds and into the study. Thad was rising slowly to his feet, a weeping twin in each arm. Liz ran to them and took them from him. Her hands flew over them, looking for wounds.
"Okay," Thad said. "I think they're okay."
Alan went to the ragged hole in the study wall. He looked out and saw a scene from some malign fairy tale. The sky was black with birds, and yet in one place it was ebony, as if a hole had been torn in the fabric of reality. This black hole bore the unmistakable shape of a struggling man. The birds lifted it higher, higher, higher. It reached the tops of the trees and seemed to pause there. Alan thought he heard a high-pitched, inhuman scream from the center of that cloud. Then the sparrows began to move again. In a way, watching them was like watching a film run backward. Black streams of sparrows boiled from all the shattered windows in the house. They funneled upward from the driveway, the trees, and the curved roof of Raleigh's Volkswagen. They all moved toward that central darkness. That man-shaped patch began to move again, over the trees, into the dark sky. And there it was lost to view. Liz was sitting in the corner, the twins in her lap, rocking them, comforting them. But neither of them seemed particularly upset any longer. They were looking cheerily up into her haggard, tear-stained face. Wendy patted it, as if to comfort her mother. William reached up, plucked a feather from her hair, and examined it closely.
"He's gone,"
Thad said hoarsely. He had joined Alan at the hole in the study wall.
"Yes," Alan said.
He suddenly burst into tears. He had no idea that was coming.
It just happened.
Thad tried to put his arms around him, and Alan stepped away, his boots crunching dryly in drifts of dead sparrows.
"No," he said. "I'll be all right."
Thad was looking out through the ragged hole again, into the night. A sparrow came out of that dark and landed on his shoulder.
"Thank you," Thad said to it.
The sparrow pecked him, suddenly and viciously, bringing blood just below his eye. Then it flew away to join its mates.
"Why?"
Liz asked. She was looking at Thad in shocked wonder.
"Why did it do that?"
Thad did not respond, but he thought he knew the answer. He thought Raleigh de Lesseps would have known, too. What had just happened was magical enough, but it had been no fairy tale. Perhaps the last sparrow had been moved by some force which felt Thad needed to be reminded of that, forcibly reminded.
"Be careful, Thaddeus. No man controls the agents of the afterlife. Not for long. And there is always a price."
"What price will I have to pay?" he wondered coldly. Then,
"And the bill? When does it come due?"
But that was a question for another time, another day. And there was this. Perhaps the bill had been paid. Perhaps he was finally even.
"Is he dead?"
Liz was asking, almost begging.
"Yes," Thad said.
"He's dead, Liz. Third time's the charm. The book is closed on George Stark. Come on, you guys. Let's get out of here." And that was what they did. Epilogue. Henry did not kiss Mary Lou that day, but he did not leave her without a word either, as he could have done. He saw her, he endured her anger, and waited for it to subside into that blockaded silence he knew so well. He had come to recognize that most of these sorrows were hers, and not to be shared or even discussed. Mary Lou had always danced best when she danced alone. At last they walked through the field and looked once more at the playhouse where Evelyn had died 3 years ago. It was not much of a goodbye, but it was the best they could do. Henry felt it was good enough. He put Evelyn's little paper ballerinas in the high grass by the ruined stoop, knowing the wind would carry them off soon enough. Then he and Mary Lou left the old place together for the last time. It wasn't good, but it was all right. Right enough. He was not a man who believed in happy endings. What little serenity he knew came chiefly from that. The Sudden Dancers by Thaddeus Beaumont. People's dreams, their real dreams, as opposed to those hallucinations of sleep which come or not just as they will, end at different times. Thad Beaumont's dream of George Stark ended at 9:15 on the night the psychopomps carried his dark half away to whatever place it was that had been appointed to him. It ended with the Black Tornado, that tarantula in which he and George had always arrived at this house in his recurrent nightmare. Liz and the twins were at the top of the driveway, where it merged with Lake Lane. Thad and Alan stood by George Stark's black car, which was no longer black. Now it was gray with bird droppings. Alan didn't want to look at the house, but he could not take his eyes from it. It was a splintered ruin. The east side, the study side, had taken the brunt of the punishment, but the entire house was a wreck. Huge holes gaped everywhere. The railing hung from the deck on the lakeside like a jointed wooden ladder. There were huge drifts of dead birds in a circle around the building. They were caught in the folds of the roof. They stuffed the gutters. The moon had come up and had sent back silverish tinkles of light from sprays of broken glass. Sparks of that same elf light dwelt deep in the glazing eyes of the dead sparrows. "You're sure this is okay with you?" Thad asked. Alan nodded. "I ask because it's destroying evidence." Alan laughed harshly. "Would anyone believe what it's evidence of?" "I suppose not." He paused and then said, "You know, there was a time when I felt that you sort of liked me. I don't feel that anymore. Not at all. I don't understand it. Do you hold me responsible for all this?" "I don't give a fuck," Alan said. "It's over. That's all I give a fuck about, Mr. Beaumont. Right now, that's the only thing in the whole world I give a fuck about." He saw the hurt on Thad's tired, harrowed face and made a great effort. "Look, Thad, it's too much. Too much all at once. I just saw a man carried off into the sky by a bunch of sparrows. Give me a break, okay?" Thad nodded. "I understand." "No, you don't," Alan thought. "You don't understand what you are, and I doubt that you ever will. Your wife might, although I wonder if things will ever be right between the two of you after this, if she'll ever want to understand or dare to love you again. Your kids, maybe, someday. But not you, Thad. Standing next to you is like standing next to a cave some nightmarish creature came out of. The monster is gone now, but you still don't like to be too close to where it came from. Because there might be another. Probably not. Your mind knows that. But your emotions, they play a different tune, don't they? Oh, boy, and even if the cave is empty forever, there are the dreams. And the memories. There's Homer Gamache, for instance, beaten to death with his own prosthetic arm. Because of you, Thad. All because of you." That wasn't fair, and part of Alan knew it. Thad hadn't asked to be a twin. He hadn't destroyed his twin brother in the womb out of malice. "We're not talking about Cain rising up and slaying Abel with a rock," Dr. Pritchard had said. He had not known what sort of monster was waiting when he began writing as George Stark. Still, they had been twins. And he could not forget the way Stark and Thad had laughed together. That crazy, loony laughter and the look in their eyes. He wondered if Liz would be able to forget. A little breeze gusted and blew the nasty smell of LP gas toward him. "Let's burn it," he said abruptly. "Let's burn it all. I don't care who thinks what later on. There's hardly any wind. The fire trucks will get here before it spreads much in any direction. If it takes some of the woods around this place, so much the better." "I'll do it," Thad said. "You go on up with Liz. Help with the twin." "We'll do it together," Alan said. "Give me your socks." "What?" "You heard me. I want your socks." Alan opened the door of the Tornado and looked inside. Yes, a standard shift, as he'd thought. A macho man like George Stark would never be satisfied with an automatic. That was for married Walter Mitty types like Thad Beaumont. Leaving the door open, he stood on one foot and took off his right shoe and sock. Thad watched him and began to do the same. Alan put his shoe back on and repeated the process with his left foot. He had no intention of putting his bare feet down in that mass of dead birds, even for a moment. When he was done, he knotted the two cotton socks together. Then he took Thad's and added them to his own. He walked around to the passenger side rear, dead sparrows crunching under his shoes like newspaper, and opened the Toronado's fuel port. He spun off the gas cap and stuck the makeshift fuse into the throat of the tank. When he pulled it out again, it was soaked. He reversed it, sticking in the dry end, leaving the wet end hanging against the guano-splattered flank of the car. Then he turned to Thad, who had followed him. Alan fumbled in the pocket of his uniform shirt and brought out a book of paper matches. It was the sort of matchbook they give you at newsstands with your cigarettes. He didn't know where he had gotten this one, but there was a stamp-collecting ad on the cover. The stamp shown was a picture of a bird. Like the socks when the car starts to roll, Alan said. Not a moment before. Do you understand?
Yes.
It'll go with a bang. The house will catch, then the LP tanks around back. When the fire inspectors get here, it's going to look like your friend lost control and hit the house and the car exploded. At least that's what I hope.
Okay.
Alan walked back around the car.
What's going on down there? Liz called nervously. The babies are getting cold.
Just another minute, Thad called back. Alan reached into the tornado's unpleasantly smelly interior and popped the emergency brake. Wait until it's rolling, he called back over his shoulder.
Yes.
Alan depressed the clutch with his foot and put the Hurst shifter into neutral. The tornado began to roll at once. He drew back, and for a moment he thought Thad hadn't managed his end. And then the fuse blazed a light against the rear of the car in a bright line of flame. The tornado rolled slowly down the last 15 feet of driveway, bumped over the little asphalt curb there, and coasted tiredly onto the small back porch. It thumped into the side of the house and stopped. Alan could read the bumper sticker clearly in the orange light of the fuse. High-toned son of a bitch.
Not anymore, he muttered.
What?
Never mind. Get back. The car's going to blow.
They had retreated 10 paces when the tornado turned into a fireball. Flame shot up the pecked and splintered east side of the house, turning the hole in the study wall into a staring black eyeball.
Come on, Alan said. Let's get to my cruiser. Now that we've done it, we've got to turn in the alarm. No need for everybody in the lake to lose their places over this.
But Thad lingered a moment longer, and Alan lingered with him. The house was dry wood beneath cedar shingles, and it was catching fast. The flames boiled into the hole where Thad's study was, and as they watched, sheets of paper were caught in the draft the fire had created and were pulled outward and upward. In the brightness, Alan could see that they were covered with words written in longhand. The sheets of paper crinkled, caught fire, charred, and turned black. They flew upward into the night above the flames like a swirling squadron of dark birds. Once they were above the draft, Alan thought that more normal breezes would catch them. Catch them and carry them away. Perhaps even to the ends of the earth.
Good, he thought.
And began to walk up the driveway toward Liz and the babies with his head down. Behind him, Thad Beaumont slowly raised his hands and placed them over his face. He stood there like that for a long time. November 3rd, 1987 to March 16th, 1989. Afterward. The name Alexis Machine is not original to me. Readers of Dead City by Shane Stevens will recognize it as the name of the fictional hoodlum boss in that novel. The name so perfectly summed up the character of George Stark and his own fictional crime boss that I adopted it for the work you have just read. But I also did it as an homage to Mr. Stevens, whose other novels include Rat Pack, By Reason of Insanity, and The Anvil Chorus. These works, where the so-called criminal mind and a condition of irredeemable psychosis interweave to create their own closed system of perfect evil, are three of the finest novels ever written about the dark side of the American dream. They are, in their own way, as striking as Frank Norris's McTeague or Theodore Dreiser's Sister Carrie. I recommend them unreservedly, but only readers with strong stomachs and stronger nerves need apply. S.K. End of The Dark Half by Stephen King. Narrated by Chuck Benson in the studios of Talking Book Publishers, Incorporated, for the Library of Congress, June 1990. For special distribution as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, Viking Penguin, a division of Penguin Books USA, Incorporated, 40 West 23rd Street, New York, New York, 10010. If you experienced any difficulty with this recording, please tie a piece of string around one of the container flaps or latches before returning it. Place the defective recording in the container braille side down for identification.